How about the Brexit?
That's fucked up.
How fucked up is that?
That's pretty fucked up. It is. I don't know what to say. What can you say?
Yeah, and we've got an election in a week.
It's all just fucked up. The whole political system's fucked up.
That's so depressing.
It is.
I'm going to vote Green.
I've already voted.
But you haven't heard all the arguments.
I've got postal vote.
You haven't heard the full... What if something happens in the next week, you can't change the vote?
Well, what fucking arguments? I didn't vote Labor or Liberal, so what fucking arguments do I need to listen to?
That's fair enough. No, fuck it. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and kittens. I've got kittens. Hi, everyone. I have kittens. I just had to say that straight because it's exciting.
How old are they now?
Now they're 13 weeks old.
So for in kitten years, that's about 15.
No. They're still kids. They're still like... they're in the terrible twos.
Have they started smoking doobies?
No, they're just destroying the place.
Yeah, they're totally.
You know what they did? Oh my god!
Wait, they're 13 weeks, but they weren't here 4 weeks ago. So you got them at 9 weeks.
Got them at eight weeks. Okay. Yeah, we're a bit late with this podcast. Sorry, listeners. We had stuff. They ate my mouse skeleton.
Oh, you're shitting me!
No.
Wait, how'd they get to the mouse skeleton?
Well, my beetles ate all the flesh of it, and then I just had it sitting there, making sure there were no beetles left. And I didn't realise they could get up on the sideboard yet, but they climbed the curtain, which now has a huge tear in it. One of them, I don't know who, and they just took the mouse skeleton out of its little bowl and ate it.
And the bones and everything?
Well, it was only bones because my beetles had eaten all the flesh of it.
Didn't the bones get caught in their throats?
Well, it's a little tiny mouse, so I found this one pathetic little arm just sitting there. The rest of the skeleton.
I don't know what's more disgusting, them eating the skeleton or you having it with the beetles pulled the flesh off.
It took my beetles weeks to...
And aren't those little beetles behind you?
Yeah, they are the... Yeah.
They're the beetles.
It took them weeks to get rid of that skeleton.
So listeners, I'm staring over at Kirsten's left, right shoulder, whatever it is, at a bunch of beetles. It's just a wonderful house, this
house. They're only
it's a cornucopia.
They're just eating some dried meat at the moment.
Oh,
nothing,
well, good on them. Yeah,
But it literally took them almost a month to strip that skeleton properly.
What happens when the beetles try to take over the house?
They won't. And there's only a small colony.
If you put them in a cup.
Why would I put them in a cup?
I haven't finished yet. And you then put them over Jason's naked body at night, would they eat him up?
No. They don't like wet stuff.
Ugh.
What's Jason
doing at night?
No, you have to dry. You have to strip most of the flesh off the skeleton and then let what's left dry out completely like beef jerky, and then they'll strip what's left because they only eat the dried up desiccated stuff. But they'll take every single shred of flesh off the skeletons and then I can
articulate
them.
Just so I know. If I ever need to, you know, kill someone.
No, they can't deal with big corpses, like nothing bigger than a small cat. Don't worry, my kittens
Lucy,
are safe.
Where are you?
My kittens are safe.
Lucy. Okay. So,
yes.
Have we actually started
anyway,
the podcast?
Anyway, we kind of have, but we got distracted somehow by kittens and beetles. Huh.
That was top of mind, not the fact that I've been hounded by random people with words. Didn't you think I'd figure it out?
No.
I
knew you would eventually, but I was wondering how long it would take.
It took me a few days.
Charles and I were considering having a side bet on how long it would take.
Yeah.
Well
done. No, you got me. Absolutely.
Did you learn lots of new words?
I knew most of them, to be fair, but not that I've taken a list. Sorry. But, yeah, that's great. You're right. I don't listen to the podcast. And if you really want to do it properly, you put it in the middle.
Yeah, I know.
To splice it in between, although now that I'm saying it, I'm now going to check the middle. Well,
maybe I'll put it like at the 25% mark. No, correct. The 27% mark.
Who knows? You could
be anywhere.
I won't listen.
No, you won't. Don't worry, I'm not going to do that every month. Not every month. And it won't be new words, I've done that. It's going to be something else. Listeners, here's Ian's address.
Flesh-eating beetles in the mail.
Let's not do that.
Okay, so.
So, that all aside, how have you been?
Good. Do we want to date this podcast and say that we're recording the day after Brexit? I think we should, just to give it the historical import it deserves.
It is the 25th of June 2016. Yeah, we actually should do that because there's no way from listening to our podcast to know what date they recorded.
Well,
I title the file with the date, but still.
They're not meant to be time capsules. They're not meant to be.
No, but you know.
You should listen to our first ever podcast and not think, wow, did internet exist back then? Because the books, we're talking about books, you know, but I think, you know, I was at work and I was just refreshing the Guardian website all day.
That's very sad. It's very
it is.
Sad
it was
thing.
History happening my, right
my
in front of me.
Sympathies to those of our listeners in the UK who wished they could stay in the EU. It's very sad. It's weird. Like, we don't really have any investment in it, you and I, except I kind of feel like I do.
The financial markets that we live on.
Well,
Who knows where my superannuation is invested in? I mean, a percentage of it could be invested in the UK, and now it's just been wiped off. Who knows? I don't.
Who knows? Well, there you go.
That is my fault that I don't know, but that's.
You should know.
Do you even have super?
Yes.
Good. Do you know where it all goes?
Yes.
Okay, let's not talk about your financials.
It's not. I mean, I don't know where every dollar goes, but I know broadly where it is invested.
To just get off Brexit, because this is not a Brexit podcast, and frankly, I'm pretty sure people will be sick of it by the time they listen to this. Can we thank our listeners?
Okay.
For the courts.
What? Oh, for the courts. Yes, we have.
No, not thank our listeners for bugging me for a week. And actually, after I'd figured out they were still bugging me.
I know, because it's this rolling thing. Like, someone else listens to it a couple of weeks later and then goes, I'll send it. You know what?
And it hasn't worked out that I've worked it out and just sent me a word.
Like, you'll have to let me know if, like, this just keeps going. Like, in 2 years from now, a new listener who's gone back and listened to them all goes, I'll send it. You know what?
Yeah, all right. Is that like that email you still keep getting from me?
That has stopped somehow. That's actually stopped.
Thank God. All right, anyway, so can we thank our Patreon listeners?
We can because we have brand new shiny, well, not shiny, but brand new microphone cords.
They're different coloured because, so you can tell which ones are broken?
Well, like, they're not broken now because they're brand new. They are red and blue. One is red and one is blue, and that's so that, well, A, it's easy for me to visually see what outlets we're plugged into for volume control and level control. But also, yeah, if in the future, as has happened with our previous cores, one of them is a bit dodgy, I'll know which one. Whereas previously it's like, my sound kept dropping out. I wonder which cord I was using last month. So, yes, it's all – and so thank you very much, listeners. You have funded – replacement microphone cords, and you have also funded our next year's subscription of Podbean,
which means
we're
still
going to
do this bloody podcast another 12 months or less.
Another 12 months. Yeah. Yes.
Right,
yes. There we go. I'm very excited. So thank you, listeners. Actually, you know, while we're here, while we're thanking people, I might as well thank our two new patrons that we got over the last month. So thank you to Mark. And thank you to, and I'm sure this is not their real name, though it might be, Frelling Dreck. Thank you very much for your patronage. We hope you enjoy the podcasts we will deliver to you.
Now, onto the books.
Unless
there was something else you wanted to discuss.
No, let's get straight into it.
Right. I just want to point out it's about 2 degrees.
Not in the house.
No, but outside.
It's really nice and toasty in the house. We've got central heating.
Ballarat, it was amazing driving here.
We had
here.
Snow yesterday.
It was blue sky, and then suddenly there was this fog bank out of nowhere. It just appeared. Yeah. It was astonishing. Anyway.
You're lucky the old ones haven't yet emerged.
Yeah. From the fog bank here. Very nice. All right, what are we starting with?
So, on to the books, because we're not Galactic Suburbia. We're not going to talk about weather for half an hour.
Why would you burn them like that? That's so rude.
Actually, I love hearing them talk about the weather. I genuinely do. Anyway, on to the books. So the loose theme for this month was to choose two very well-respected, critically acclaimed, well-regarded authors who've been writing and publishing for a long time and who somehow you and I have never gotten around to reading, at least in novel length, because I'm pretty sure I've read a couple of short stories from both of them.
I've not read a single word from either of them.
But I couldn't put my finger on it. And they were Doris Lessing and Octavia Butler.
Yes.
Which it's like I'm almost – in fact, I am. I'm kind of ashamed that I just haven't actually read either of them before.
Yeah. Anyway, I'll get to that.
Especially
when we get...
since back in the day when we used to go to a the Nova Mob, sort of a local discussion group in Melbourne. And, it has to be about 15 years ago. Someone, and I can't even remember who now, actually gave a talk about Doris Lessing. And I remember thinking, I must read her. And I still,
that's the other point. It's not like we're unaware of these authors.
No, completely aware of them. I even have Kindred on my bookshelf. It's like, oh, God. Yes, yeah, so we've rectified that, at least in part.
Well,
we've read one book. We haven't read more. I don't think
I didn't run out and read Lessing's. No.
No.
No, I didn't.
Because you do actually track what you're reading. So
how do you know what I'm reading?
You put it on your blog.
Yeah.
Except you haven't for a couple of weeks.
No, I put it on my Goodreads and my Facebook.
Yeah, so we know everyone knows what you're reading.
Spies. Which one are we starting with?
I think if you make information public, you can't call it espionage.
What are we starting with?
Let us start with...
The shorter of the two.
It was short, wasn't it? The Fifth Child by Doris Lessing.
It's just over 40,000 words.
It's a really small book.
It wouldn't even be called a novel in the Hugos.
No. So you got an e-copy, so you know the word count.
Yes.
Excellent, because I thought you would. I'm reading it going, this can't be more than 50,000 words. Ian will know.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's 44,000. Yeah.
And it was published in 1988, so that's what you can get away with literary fiction.
Well, they still do it now. What did you publish in 1988? This book's published in 2016 that are barely 40,000 words.
That's what I'm saying, literary fiction.
But you made out like you could get away with it in 1988 with literary fiction.
Oh, okay. I didn't mean those. I was just saying it was published in 1988 and unrelatedly... In general, you can get away with writing much shorter novels, indeed novellas, in literary fiction, whereas speculative fiction, until the last couple of years, has kind of been publishing standalone books of sizable page counts. But, you know, that trend I think is changing. Tor is bringing out standalone novellas as books,
yes,
which is lovely to see. I'm kind of hoping the novella length will become more common. It's a very nice length. But anyway, Doris Lessing. I know.
Thanks for that political position on book length.
I'm so political.
Wow, you've really gone to town on that book. That's a library book as well.
What do you mean?
Well, look at all the pages you've marked.
I haven't marked anything.
No, you've done a little...
I dog-eared.
Yeah.
That's
someone
okay.
might want to read that one day and they have the bloody creases in the page.
That's fine. They'll know which ones I found fascinating.
The book is The Fifth Child by Doris Lessing. Do you like how I did that? What can you tell us about the book, Kirsten?
Well, I can't read you the flap copy because as it is a book I borrowed from the library, the dust jacket has been removed. But it's about a couple, David and Harriet Lovett.
Yes.
And it begins set somewhere in the 1960s and they meet at an office party and... It's funny. I don't know that you'd say fall in love. They connect very strongly. But I was thinking about it in retrospect. There's really not a lot of, romantic language in the book.
No, there is none. Very little. They're just compatible.
Yeah, they meet. They're like, hey, we're simpatico. We both want the same things.
Correct.
You know, we both aspire to have the same kind of life.
Yeah.
But there's actually not a lot of talk about
But we don't want to say that they're forced into it or
No.
They genuinely admire
not.
Each other at the very least.
Yeah, but it's funny because you think about it, you know, it's a very strong, committed relationship they have until the bad thing happens. But there's actually not a lot of talk about falling in love and romance and all that sort of stuff. They're quite pragmatic people in a way. It's like all of their romantic inclinations are reserved for the idea of this big, wonderful family they want to have.
Yes.
Rather than for each other. So it's interesting. But anyway, so they meet at this party, immediately kind of realize their compatibility and their shared goals for how they want their lives to be. And it's a rarity because what they each want a nice big family, like 8 or 10 children, which is horrifying from the get-go to me. And, you know, a big house where people will come to visit all the time and that will be sort of a hub of family activity. And so they get married and embark on this quest, which works quite well for them for 4 children. And then the fifth child is conceived. Dun, dun, dun.
And it goes to shit from day – for not the, just the birth, but even pre-birth.
The pregnancy.
Harriet's in pain.
Yeah, it's
– having the child is just kicking – it wants to kick its way out from – Yeah, 4 or 5 months
she has quite – she has such a
– GP utterly useless.
Well, her first four children I don't want to say like her first four children, the pregnancies and births were easy because there is – you know, they were not like, you know, oh, massively easy, not a problem at all. Whoosh, there goes the baby. But the fifth child from – almost from day one of when she realizes she's pregnant, the pregnancy is quite painful, never life-threatening, just really –
Well, she has to walk. She has to keep walking to reduce the pain.
Yeah.
That's never good.
No, no. But, I mean, there's – and she
begs – And her GP is useless.
Yes.
She's sort of mollycoddling. You'll be all right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, have you seen this before? Well, that's not relevant whether I've seen it before or not.
Some babies are more active than others.
Yeah. Tap, pat.
So, yeah, quite a patronising sort of
Harriet
attitude.
Is patronised throughout the entire novel from get-go.
She really
not,
is.
Not, to be fair, by her husband, although he does sort of towards – there are parts when he might a little bit, but everyone else in the family patronises Harriet.
Well, everyone – I think everyone patronises both of them.
Well, yes,
the,
true.
The interesting – because their goal, like as I said, this when they meet, this is the swinging 60s. There's a kind of a point made that their aspirations and their values are running quite counter to the prevailing culture as it's seen. I think that's historically inaccurate, but certainly the idea we have of the 1960s of you know, so they're quite conservative attitudes and desire to have a large family, simply to have a large family.
Well, there's a thing, isn't there a point made that Harriet's a virgin?
Yeah. Oh yeah. And they're sexually conservative and,
yeah.
And yeah, so it kind of runs counter to the prevailing pop culture sort of attitudes. But just the idea that, like, you know, even I think even in the 1940s and 50s, which we kind of perceive as a very conservative time, a really large family by that time was very unusual. And they are talking about, like, when they first meet, it's like, oh, I kind of want 6 children. Oh, we could have 7. We could have 8. You know, like, they want a very large family. It's not just 4 or 5 children they want. They want a very large family. So this sort of goal is – it's patronised and it's definitely frowned upon. But it's not and partly because the large family that they want. But also I think primarily it's not simply just that, oh, you want 10 children, how weird. It's just they can't afford it. They can't. They're just – the house they buy is this huge house which – and it's quite away from London where David has to work. So his commute is really long. And their entire life and the way they want their life to be is subsidized financially and emotionally by their family, by their parents.
Well, by David specifically, David's father.
Well, and Harriet's mother. Here's the thing, right? David's father provides the money because he's wealthy and
Dorothy provides the moral support
and Harriet, not just moral support.
The childcare.
Poor Dorothy, who's a grandmother who has other children who have children, including one of her other daughters who, during the timeline of the book, gives birth to a daughter with Down syndrome. But Dorothy is pretty much in chains.
Well, she becomes a live-in.
To David and Harriet.
She becomes a live-in.
That's right, because Harriet has the first 4 children, well, all 5 of them in very quick succession. Yeah. And because David's away almost all the time in London working, Dorothy kind of moves in and she provides all of this emotional support, a lot of the actual hands-on physical labour that's required to take care of small children.
And she's resentful because she's been telling them stop having kids.
This is
from, like, day one before they even had the first kid.
So I mean, because you were talking about before the podcast, you were.
Oh, I haven't got to that yet.
Oh, okay. Do you want to get to that? Because I think it meshes with what we're talking
about. Well, no, because it gets into my concern in the novel, and I thought you'd want to. Well, in that the cards for me are stacked against Harriet and David from day one because they make non-rational decisions that feel more like Doris Lessing making those decisions rather than what these two people would have made they don't feel like organic decisions because they do buy a house that they cannot afford where, you know, the father has to essentially pay the mortgage.
Yeah.
David can't afford it. And then on top of that, they then have kids in quick succession after being warned constantly, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it.
Well, I mean, to be fair, they didn't necessarily plan to have them so quickly.
But no, there's this whole running gag about the pregnant. Room that yeah. their boudoir is just a baby making factory.
But I don't know what kind of birth control method they were using, because it's only later after the fifth child is born that Harriet goes on the pill. So like I'm not sure how they were controlling their fertility. Okay,
but, well, they probably weren't. But Lessing has stacked the cards against them. So by punishing these two silly people, David and Harriet, by not only having them have kids in quick succession so they can't cope, but then giving them an evil kid as well on top of it as part of a general message which says that parenthood not is a bad thing, but you need to be very smart and careful before you have kids, which, you know, is true. But
I don't know that it talks about parenthood as a bad thing. Well,
it's all about family and motherhood and parent. There's this whole line about each time Easter or Christmas, this cousin comes, this young girl, Melody, I think her name is, who talks about how she's inspired by Harriet and David, because they're the ones living the dream of having a big family, until she sees that it's all gone to shit and never turns up again, this girl.
Yeah. Look, no, I can see where you're coming from with that reading. I was looking at it because we do have other examples of parenting in the book. We have Harriet's other sisters who come and bring their children, and I don't necessarily think the book is anti-children. I think what it's looking at is the idea of having very unrealistic fantasies. And yet the misfortune is in the end quite unfortunate for all concerned, including the child, the fifth child. But yeah, no, I can see where you're coming from, but I didn't, because to me the stuff that is I wouldn't call it stacked against them, because the decisions they make, and I don't think they're necessarily...
They're saying that Lessing is saying that Harriet and David are essentially selfish.
They are essentially selfish.
The way the cards are stacked against them, yeah, they are. But people have big families in the world that aren't selfish, that, you know, even whether it's go from foster families to, you know, families that have foster kids, to just keep families that have 8 or 9 children.
Yeah.
So they don't, you know, they aren't selfish. They work it through. They budget for it. They do what they have to do.
But this is what David and Harriet don't do. They don't budget for it. They take for granted.
And I didn't believe in them as characters as a result.
Oh, really?
They felt just, I don't know, at the whims of fate, at the whims of the author. That's how it felt to me.
Oh, fair enough. I didn't. I felt that, you know, I don't think it's any kind of a stretch to imagine people buying their dream house even when they can't afford it. People do it right now in this country.
Right? They default.
And
that.
You know, and I understand, and in the US there's a massive, and that's partially because of the very bad financial structures that have been set up. But this is the thing, people do buy their dream stuff.
That's not what the book is about.
But that's part
it's
of it.
It's about an evil kid.
Well,
because if it was a book about struggling with four children and a house you can't afford, then fine, that's the book. But then Lessing chucks an evil kid on, and I put this in scare quotes, an evil kid on them as well. Why?
Because it's interesting to me.
It's the capstone. It's to say, we were right all along. See, now you've had an evil kid. That's how fucked you guys are. How fucking selfish and stupid. You wouldn't listen. And now you've got an evil kid.
Yeah, no, I can see how you could look at that as this is a maybe, punishment. Yeah.
It is. No, absolutely, it's punitive.
Yep. No, I just look at it as this.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt.
No. And look, I we'll get on to the fifth child in a minute, but His name's Ben. It's deeply troubling, his depiction.
Well, the whole book's depiction of disability is deeply troubling. But anyway, keep going on.
But even though this book, like the narrative style of this book it's very much a story that's being told. So there's not massive amounts of direct dialogue. We're being told things rather than a lot of very intimate showing. You know, you never forget that you're being told a story. And 40,000 odd words, but there's not a single chapter or section break.
No.
Which is quite astonishing. And you are kind of pulled through this book. You are given no more of a breather than Harriet is.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the strengths of the book, that it, is, it really does take you by the net.
Because you have no time to pause.
Correct.
You are just constantly going through the book until you kind of fall asleep and have to put it down and start again the next morning. But you're constantly being pulled through the book in the way that, that Harriet is. And I think it's stylistic choices like that which make me feel that the book is sympathetic to Harriet's situation. And also, despite the fact that it's very much a told story and has a sophisticated narrative tone as opposed to a naive tone, and I mean naive in the sense of we're pretending this story isn't being told to us by an author, that it's just something we're encountering, it's still all Harriet's point of view. And it took me a little while to realise that. But the entire thing is Harriet's point of view. We don't get to know anything that David's thinking. No, it is. Because even when we're told something that David is feeling or thinking, it's Harriet's
true.
Perception.
If it dips into a point of view, it's always Harriet's.
It's always Harriet.
But it's not. It's not.
No, but
it's
even,
omniscient or Harriet.
Oh, it's not omniscient. Like the only way we're told what other characters are feeling or thinking is when Harriet is either inferring it or when, we're told Harriet was blah blah blah. Is actually all Harriet's point of view, which is really interesting for a book which feels like, as you say, it feels like it's almost an omniscient narrator, which it is, but only filtered through what Harriet feels and thinks and knows and guesses. So a lot of and it is patronising the way they're being treated, but it feels like it's, as you said before, it feels like it's Harriet who's mostly being patronised, but that's because it's we're just viewing this through Harriet. So we're getting to experience how she is experiencing her motherhood and her life and her isolation, because she is quite isolated from the world in this house, which is kind of how she wanted it, how they both wanted it. They wanted this house to be sort of their haven, I guess, from the world. But, yeah, so it's this fantasy they've both sort of constructed for themselves, and the fantasy only works because they're reliant on other people.
No,
and
you're right,
and as all the other people point out, it is a really selfish fantasy. The idea that they could have this great big wonderful house and all of these children when they can't afford it and they don't have the money and they don't have the emotional capacity to do it.
And I'm even willing to accept that.
And then
why have an evil kid as the capstone?
That's because they've had something that's come in to disrupt the fantasy. But really interestingly, Harriet, almost from, well, during the birth, definitely she starts to think about it, but certainly once Ben is born, she then switches her fantastical capacity, which is a very positive, or which generates very positive, visions for how her life is, to a very negative fantasy. This child must be a changeling. He must be non-human. He must be. So her capacity for fantasizing about how the world is and how the world should be is just shifted from this utopia.
You're right. She's fickle and psychologically fragile. Absolutely. You
know, well, I don't know that she's fickle. Well, she fantasizes deeply.
Okay.
And it was. And again, the book, because...
Well, no, but she's psychologically fragile, though.
Yeah, she... well, she is. But the way the book is filtered through Harriet, it is really interesting because it's very hard to untangle. Like, you talk, what Lessing is doing is this, what Lessing is saying is this, but it's actually all what Harriet is thinking and saying and feeling. And it's, I find it problematic in a book like this to disentangle that from I guess, the... diegetic information that the book is putting across. Because I think the book is very sympathetic to Harriet. I think book has...
No, I don't.
You don't think
so? It destroys her completely. Any dream she had of anything is gone. She loses all of her children. Not they don't die. She loses
no,
she
they,
loses
they
her husband.
Away. Because let's get to Ben.
Okay.
The fifth child. So he's born, and as we said, her pregnancy is not life-threatening, but very uncomfortable and painful and difficult. And certainly...
I have to say, Lessing does a brilliant job there. I really felt Harriet's pain.
Yeah.
I wanted to get up and walk around.
I know. Like, just get that child out of her.
Can we should get born. And you are a fuckwit, you GP.
Yeah.
She's in pain. Sort the woman out, for Christ's sakes. I don't care that it's 1970-something, and you may not have the technology. Just do something.
But, you know, and I will say ongoing, not certainly not in all areas of medicine, but, you know, one of the themes of medicine in the last couple of centuries has been to downplay, if not ignore, the pain and discomfort and symptoms that women present. So this is saying pregnancy is hard. It should be painful. What are you complaining about? Just get through it. It's only 9 months.
There's a bit where she shows the doctor, look, he's punching my skin, for Christ's sake.
He goes, oh, that's an active child. But I mean, that's...
I don't want to derail this and make this all about the GP, but it just fucking annoyed me. Anyway, keep going.
But it, like, to me, anyway. So when he's born and he's the only child that they have outside of the house, because they have all of their other children at home in the marital bed.
With a bottle of champagne. You
know, exactly. It's, again, this kind of fantastical idea of what childbirth should be like. Yep. And Ben disrupts that. Mainly because Harriet wants him induced and she just wants him gone. So she's taken a guinea from the start. but when he's born, he's a much larger child than the others were, and his the physical descriptions of him are not flattering.
Not at all.
You know, they talk about he has yellowish skin, like a jaundice type of skin. She calls him. And it's funny because, like, and this is how clever Lessing is, because she feeds in the foundations of what becomes Harriet's fantasy about this child very early. So when they first say, oh, he looks like a troll, he's a bit of a troll, they're not speaking literally, but it doesn't take too long before Harriet begins to speak literally about this child being not human.
Yep. They jump to that conclusion
pretty quickly. And she talks about, Harriet does.
You're right, Harriet does.
And it's interesting because, like, she did carry this child and the pregnancy was bad from the start, so he can't be a changeling. It's not like her pregnancy was fine and she had a normal child and then one day she goes, was swapped. But she does talk about him being a changeling without clearly being able to, like, she just pushes aside the fact that that cannot be reconciled with the fact that she did conceive and carry this child. And she's not at any time thinking, oh, he must have been swapped after I gave birth to him. So it's funny how she can incorporate that sort of, or overlook that cognitive dissonance in her own fantasy world. Like, her ability to fantasize is very sophisticated. But anyway, so Ben is a problem child. He cries, and he doesn't just cry. I mean, Harriet describes it as roaring and bellowing. He doesn't like to be touched. He doesn't like human company. It takes him quite a while to learn to talk. Harriet perceives him as very malicious. It kind of brought to mind, we need to talk about Kevin.
Yeah, that, same that sort the, of. Yep.
And again, it's all, even though the tone of the novel feels omniscient, it's actually all Harriet's perception and her point of view. And this is how she's feeling about this child. And the whole time I'm reading it, I'm like, Ben, to me, maps onto, not perfectly, but maps onto children who have autism. And again, it's not all autistic children, but a lot of the symptoms he's displaying map very well to autism. So the discomfort, if not refusal of affection and touch, the sensitivity to sensations and noises that he has, the very late speaking and then beginning to speak in perfect sentences.
Yep.
There's a whole bunch of things. The inability, as it's said throughout, like, Harriet realizes he's not intuitively picking up human behaviors and facial expressions. And he's having to try very hard to realize what people's faces mean. And he's mimicking people. He becomes very good at mimicking. Yeah. So if they're watching something on the television and the other children laugh, he kind of sees them laugh and processes that and then kind of laughs himself. So he's mimicking all of that. So I felt deeply sorry for Ben, because he's born into this family that doesn't know how to deal with this child, because they've got this fantasy about how children should be and family should be and what their life should be.
And what's their response?
And Ben completely disrupts this life.
And what's their response?
Oh God, it's horrific.
It's horrific.
It's horrific.
Isn't it horrific?
Yeah. So they, against Harriet's wishes, she's kind of browbeaten into it. But
it's by the fact that she has issues with Ben, and clearly,
well, everyone. This is the thing: everyone has issues with Ben. But in a almost
sense,
hates
in
his
a
child
sense, she's
from the
convinced,
start.
She's convinced everyone else around her that Ben is a monster. But she has, but she doesn't like the solution that they come up with, which is basically to institutionalize Ben.
But It's not just that Ben is a child, a normal child with scare quotes, or that Ben has some difficulties. Ben is, like, his behavior is extremely antisocial, to the point where he's killed animals. He's physically violent with his siblings, especially his, like, the second youngest, Paul,
who scares the complete shit out of
him. Who really adored the new baby and is traumatized by some stuff that Ben does. So it's not just that Harriet has convinced other people. Everyone is looking at this child who is having huge difficulties integrating into the world, and no one knows what to do with him. Like, Harriet's mother, Dorothy, is like, no, you can't, like, you need to send this child away. He's ruining the family. Everyone. Like, when people, because one of the things that they do is, like, every Christmas and Easter,
it's both holidays.
All of the family come. So all of, as many as they can of David and Harriet's sisters and parents, and because David has four sets of, well, two parents and then two step-parents to match. And everyone comes, and it's a huge house, and it's full of life. But it's interesting because it's always like, again.
It's a bitching session, I found, those.
Yeah,
But there's a lot of bitching about Harriet and David at these get-togethers,
and Harriet is often resentful too. It's almost like it's this thing that they have fantasized to do, so they feel an obligation to do it, and yet, it's quite strange. Like, because there's remarks made by Harriet and David how all their family comes, but, you know, they don't really contribute; they just come to kind of, you know, sponge off us. Although, at the same time, it's made quite clear that everyone pitches in because Harriet always has a new baby. So everyone is actually pitching in to clean and cook and take care of the children. So it's like everything from Harriet and David's perspective is like, well, you know, everyone is against us. But actually everyone is helping, even though they're saying, you know, maybe you should think about not having another kid so soon because you're really tired, Harriet. You look really tired, and you are tired. You can't even get out of your chair. So it's this – interesting. Like, I think the perspective of the novel is really cleverly done, and it is like when you realize that the book is actually from Harriet's perspective and everything is filtered through how she sees it and feels it, it is really interesting to try to disentangle.
But I didn't like her family. Her family, even though I know it's through her perspective, I didn't like them, and they proved to be right, and it's annoying. Anyway, get to Ben. What happens to Ben?
So
horror of Ben.
So, like, all the family who comes, like, recognize that Ben is not like the other children, and in fact, he is dangerous. Like, everyone watches Ben because he's going to, like, kill a kid.
Yeah,
it's what they're worried about. And he certainly kills someone's dog, or is it a cat?
It's
a cat.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they're worried about this dog.
Correct.
Anyway, so there's all of this stuff around Ben. And so they finally convince Harriet, David's natural mother and her new husband, who are academics. It's very anti-academic.
Oh, my
actually.
God. Oh.
If anything, it's more anti-academic than it is anti-motherhood. They find this place that you can take these types of children to. And Ben is whisked away. And we don't see the place to begin with. And he's just taken away, and you get the impression he's gone into an institution.
Yeah.
And that's really sad in itself. But also you think, well, this family really wasn't coping with this child. And back in the 70s, there probably wasn't a lot of support. I mean, it was very common for children with disabilities, especially severe intellectual disabilities, to be put into an institution because it was, you know, it is difficult to cope with a child who has intense needs, especially when you have four other children as well. And there's much made of the fact that all of Harriet's attention and her emotional capacity is focused on Ben once he's born, even though she resents him. She has to focus all of her attention on him. And the resentment she feels at the same time as she feels a responsibility, like, it's so finely balanced. I found that really
She feels that Ben is hers at the end of the day. Whatever Ben's problems are, it's her responsibility.
Yeah.
It's probably the most empowering aspect to her novel.
Yeah. It is really interesting. So anyway, so they send Ben away, and after a few months,
something
I think.
Like, yeah, it's something
it's
like
not
that.
I don't think it's even a year.
Well, the guilt increases to the point.
Yeah,
that Harriet.
And Harriet decides she's going to go get Ben back, and she goes to the place, and it's
she does it on her own.
on her own because no one else, like David doesn't want her to get him back. He's yeah. completely against it. He's like, the family is starting to come back together. The children are starting to be happy. It's just the most horrific. And I've like, most of me really doesn't want to believe that anything like this place ever existed, but there's a small part of me that thinks, yeah, that's probably right. It's probably not too exaggerated. So it's this place where essentially children with...
if anyone's seen the latest season of The X-Files...
Do we need to talk about the latest season of The X-Files?
No, we don't, but episode...
I'd rather forget that exists.
Two or three has a scene where Mulder or Scully walk through it's a hospital and there's all these kids who are disabled in some way, but in horrific ways.
Mm.
That's what we get here. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if Wong got the inspiration from this
Doris book. Lessing. So she's basically, she goes to this place, which is looks like a nice big old country house from the outside, and they won't let her in at first, and she insists and says, I'm not leaving until I see my son.
And she walks down the corridor.
And through this ward with children who have quite severe physical disabilities. And obviously some that have intellectual disabilities and possibly both, and they're just kind of like some of them are tied to the beds.
Yep.
And the room that she's taken to where Ben is like I guess
it's a padded cell.
A padded cell, basically. I'm trying to – like a quiet room, I think they call them these days. I'm not sure. But, padded cell. And he's just on the floor and there's excrement and urine everywhere and he's not cleaned and they just keep him drugged all the time. And because he's drugged all the time because he's just really strong – they say he's like super strong. So because he's drugged all the time, he can't really eat. So he's essentially starving and being dehydrated to death. And it's awful. And she takes him and scarpers.
But drugs him up because she knows once
he
wakes,
because they give her
he
more,
might try and kill her
more ampules. Yeah. Because he's an extremely volatile child. And so this is how he comes back to the family. And at that point, the family disintegrates because Ben was such a disruption into this life of the family that when he went away for a while, it was like the family decompressed and started to cohere. So bringing him back is worse.
Is that Harriet thinks she can use the fear of the institution to bring Ben in line?
Yeah, she does. So she will threaten him with sending him back to that place, which again felt so like the veracity of this situation for me was very high. It felt so real.
Really, not for me. I just felt like it was just one big... As much as I admired that scene and the institution and the horror of it, it just felt like one big misery, torture, punitive, fuck you, Harriet.
This is where Harriet finds a renewed purpose in a way. She is determined that she's going to raise Ben and she's going to find a way.
And she does by getting him involved in a biker gang. And then... grows up.
We're
not going to go into detail on every aspect of the book, but
she finds older people who will take care of him.
Yeah,
and who he can connect with.
Correct.
And looks up to.
But he basically, as a result, becomes a sociopath.
He does, and like because the book doesn't have one of the things I really appreciated about the book was it doesn't swerve away from, I guess, its mission statement. There is no easy ending to this book. You do not have a child who has difficulties and there's some magic solution.
It's not an easy ending, but it's a predictable ending.
Well, actually...
It's inevitable. It's all inevitable.
Yeah.
But
Ben doesn't die. He just grows up and leaves.
Well, he grows up, leaves, becomes a violent criminal.
Possibly.
Or manipulates people to be violent on his behalf.
Possibly. Yeah.
Well, not possibly. It's pretty much
well,
said.
Again, this is all Harriet's – like yeah, so okay. much of this is how Harriet feels about her son. Now, what's really interesting is that Ben – like we have, so I guess, objective data in a way that Ben is capable of emotional connection. He is capable of caring about people because he cares very deeply about the young man who Harriet sort of employs to look after him during the day.
Yeah.
Right? And to pick him up after school and do stuff. He's capable of all that. He has a capacity, like he's not an evil child. For all of Harriet and David and the rest of their family's kind of theories about him. I mean, Harriet thinks he's a goblin child or something and David and Dorothy and the others just think he's either evil or just broken and get rid of him. I mean, no one, you know, it's funny because when she goes and rescues him from the institution and she kind of comes back and says what it's like and it's like no one is surprised. Like Harriet's the only one who's surprised. Everyone is like, well, what did you think was going to happen to him? we were essentially sending him away to die.
Yeah, that's
like it's horrific.
I know, it's horrible.
But this is what I mean. Like all of this comes through Harriet, and I found the book as like it was deeply disturbing and troubling. But I actually did find that it was sympathetic to both Harriet. And in fact, to Ben, because once you realise this is all Harriet, what it is showing you of Ben, it is showing you he's not an evil child. He is capable of forming connections with people. He is capable of caring about people.
Yes.
He is. He absolutely is. And
yes, but you know that the adults, those boy or the gang, are taking advantage of him. He's treated as a mascot.
Sure.
And yes, he creates a relationship with the gang he forms, clearly. Sure. But it's not a healthy one in any way, shape, or form.
No. But the kid has never been socialised.
No, well, true.
You know, pretty much from his birth, he's had
but again,
a family
the cards
who has
are stacked against Harriet and David. There's no inkling that this kid could ever be socialised. Yes, it's all from Harriet's perspective. I get that. But still, there's no inkling here of.
But when you say that, like, the cards are stacked, it's like, well, it is. I mean, it's a created narrative. I mean, this is what. You know, what. Yes, so this is a story about this particular family, in particular the woman of the family, and but her husband is equally contributes.
It felt like me that Lessing, and you know, you said we can't.
We need to be careful.
But all right, but that Lessing has taken a view in regards to family and parenthood and the selfishness potentially of having kids, if you're not in a particular position to do so. And has punished
not,
the two people who have
kids,
had that dream.
Not having kids. This is, I think what the book is doing is critiquing this fantasy world. Like, it's not the fact that they want kids. It's not the fact that they want a family home. It's the type of home that they want that they can't manage. It's the type of family that they want that they can't manage. And the fact that they do pretty much take for granted that the only reason they can manage it is because there is a father who is just piling money at them. There is a mother who is giving all of her time in what should be her retirement and which should also be shared out between her other children and grandchildren, and that she wants to because, as I said, one of Harriet's sisters gives birth to a child with Down syndrome, and it's very problematic language. And part of it is, I think, the language at the time that Lessing was – not at the time the book was written, but at the time it's set in the 70s when this child was born. So there is very problematic language, and it's like it was kind of confronting to read. But then you think, well, this is again, it's all, there's no room in this book to kind of critique that language because it's all from, you know, within a character, and it's all what the other characters are saying. And Harriet doesn't think any different. But that child is loved and cared for, and that child becomes a family favourite. Not at the beginning. At the beginning, everyone's horrified that
it becomes
Harriet's
a lot
sister,
more a family favourite when Ben is born. As a point of comparison, that's what I
well, as a
really
point
upsetting.
Of comparison, yeah, I can see that. So the language I found quite disturbing. But yeah, so I don't think it is necessarily anti having children, anti family, anything like that. It's more about the fantasy of this particular thing that they want, it sounds funny because it's a very conservative position that both Harriet and David have, but it's their way of rebelling against the world. Their way of rebelling against the world, because as they see it, the world has grown permissive and hyper. It's funny thinking about the 60s being hypersexual, considering how we are now. But you know, this is how they think the world is. And so their way of rebelling against it is going, no, we're going to be super conservative and we're going to have a big family and we're going to be family values first and all of this sort of stuff. So that's interesting. But so I don't think the book is a critique of that, because apart from anything else, the entire way that Harriet and David and their children manage is through the support of family. If they didn't have family, they would have crashed and burned after the second child.
Oh, absolutely.
Honestly, right? They would have been selling the house and divorce and bankruptcy and all that. And
absolutely.
So the only way they've managed to try to maintain this fantasy for so long is because of their family and the support of, you know, mothers and fathers for their children. Like, the book is both showing you this unrealistic idea, but at the same time it's also showing you how really important families are and how supportive families are.
I don't buy it.
Okay. That's fine.
I don't buy it. I think you've articulated a very strong argument. So I'm not patronising. I'm saying it. Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, but that's not how you read it. No. And look, I did find it. I found the depiction of Ben to be extremely distressing, and I felt such sympathy for this child, and I don't know how much of that is emanated from the book, because again, it's really hard. Like, it's not. I don't think it's the author or the book telling you that this child is a monster. It's Harriet. This is how she perceives her son, and it's not like this. This was and probably is still common. If you had, you know, if people had a child who was born who had physical or intellectual disabilities that were severe enough, you did send them away. Maybe not to the horrific kind of place that Ben is sent. But this is why so many people were institutionalized, because families couldn't cope and support wasn't there and understanding wasn't there. So if you had a, you know, in square quotes, a broken child, sent it away. Get another one. You know? I mean, this was a perception.
Yep. Look, okay.
And I thought the book did that very well, because and the way, as I said, the way it constructed Harriet's and to some extent David, but it is hard because it's only Harriet that we directly know. But her, as I said, her capacity to disregard the realities of the world around her, despite the data.
Which is what made her unrealistic to me.
Really? You don't think this world is full of people in complete denial about stuff, about what they can afford, what they can do, what they might be able to do in the future.
Recent historical events probably back you up more than they do back me.
I mean, this is, I think, unfortunately, I think the human capacity for denial and the creation of fantasy and the rejection of reality in favour of what you would prefer reality to be is immense, possibly infinite. And that is what I think this book was critiquing.
All right.
But I completely see how you're reading it, like the way you've read it.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, this is what's good about books. Everyone takes different stuff from them, and we get to talk about them.
Just to do a really poor segue, do you think we'll read The Butler in the same way?
I don't know.
Should we move on to it?
Was there anything else you wanted to say about the lesson?
No.
I'm really glad I read it.
Oh, like, I'm not upset I read it.
As problematic as some of the stuff about it was.
And it doesn't.
I did find it fascinating, and I found it very fascinating.
I don't know where it sits in the evil baby genre or the evil child genre, because I'm pretty sure it's post Rosemary's Baby.
It's
post IR-11 and that sort.
Absolutely. And I think in a way it is actually critiquing those genres, because as I said, it is really hard to disentangle stuff, but I honestly don't think the book is trying to say that Ben is an evil child, that Ben is a changeling, that Ben is a troll. I think the book is presenting this as Harriet's explanation for what could possibly be wrong with her child and why. And again, she's for all of her, I'm not going to go as far as to say that there's a martyrdom aspect to it, though there possibly is, but a lot of Harriet's, I guess, angst about Ben is actually about her. What has she done to deserve this?
Yeah, that's true. Well, that's right. You know? There's that selfishness that runs through the whole novel.
And the only way she's kind of able to justify it is, well, he must be a changing child, but then what have I done to deserve it?
Yep.
You know what I mean? Why is my child?
Yep.
So it's really interesting. And as I said, it's just, I think it does present Ben in a sympathetic way.
Yeah, all right.
Just because
I'm not going to repeat what all right, fine.
So, and that's what I found fascinating. I found
that I'm interested to, if our listeners do comment, I'm interested in what they think.
Yeah, but I completely see how you could read the book and go, this is just, this is horrible. And it is, like, it is, there is such awful stuff that happens in this book. And yeah, really.
I could do it with a horror novel. I just, or with horror.
Just bad, like, what people do to each other stuff. Yeah. Which gets me, always gets me much more than, oh, there's a vampire. You know, the things that people can do to each other and the way people treat each other.
Are you sure you're not talking about the Octavia Butler now? Because
well, that now a makes book. A nice segue. So that was The Fifth Child by Doris Lessing.
Do you want me to read The Back of the Blue?
I'm quite interested to read more of her work, though, you know, no promises, people, because I'm in the middle of a PhD.
I'd be interested to see what others say.
I was fascinated by the style in which it was written.
People
and the
should
way
throw,
it was
in, throw some more recommendations in.
And also, just one last thing I'll say, like, it was really interesting. The book is completely linear. Like, it's completely linear.
Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah, you know, it doesn't veer
it goes
off.
From when they meet to when Ben leaves home.
Yeah,
and,
correct.
And this family is left fractured and destroyed. Separated and gone. And it's completely linear book.
Yep.
And so you've got this sort of 14, 15 is when he leaves.
About
so
that, yeah. He's about 15.
So
yeah.
You've got about a 20-year span.
Yeah, exactly.
In 40,000 words. And it's just told as a story from go to woe. And it's, I guess, a more old-fashioned way of creating a narrative these days.
There's an old-fashionedness to the writing.
Yeah, and I thought
it had actually been written in the 60s, even though it does move forward into the future.
There was kind of a pleasure in just being told this story, in not having to, as much as you know, and I like non-conventional narratives.
I do.
But honestly, there really was this.
You truly loved this book. Because I've tried to segue twice to Octavia Butler's novel.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. Yeah.
I found it quite fascinating that, like, from craft points of view, I did find this linear told story and yeah, just the pleasure in being able to sit back and you're still thinking about the story and that, but you're not having to think about where the pieces fit. It's like, sit down, let me tell you this story. And it was, I found it quite fascinating how absorbed I was in that narrative style, though it's very old-fashioned and very few people write that way anymore.
It is compelling.
And I think very few people wrote that way in the late 80s too, to be honest. So, yeah. Anyway, Doris Lessing, The Fifth Child. I definitely recommend it with some reservations if you're touchy about, language and representation around disability. There might be some issues in there for you.
Do you want to read the back of the...
So, moving on. So the second book we're going to talk about this episode is Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower. And as we've said, neither of us have read any Octavia Butler
Not a word.
Books before. And you don't think you've read anything?
I'm Not a
pretty word. Sure I've read a short story. Anyway, so this was published in 1993 and it was the first of a two-book set. So the
I think it was meant to be a trilogy.
Well...
Not that we've read the second book. So.
No, the second book was The Book of the Talents. Yeah. And according to Wikipedia, that font of knowledge, because I was curious, Butler had planned to write a third parable novel, which was going to be called The Parable of the Trickster. And interestingly, that would have focused on the community's struggle to survive on a new planet. So they got there. And she actually began it, but then that kind of morphed into one which eventually became Fledgling. And isn't the third of the trilogy. So so at the moment it's a two-book, and I am genuinely interested to read the second book.
So am I.
I'm going to get
it. I love this book. And read Can it. I spoil and say that I love this book?
I really loved it. I'm like kicking myself. So why haven't I read Butler before? So I'll read the you wanted to. Go on, read the back.
Lauren Olamina lives in a community under siege, one of the lucky few to have a home. She's protected from the desperate violence that threatens from outside. But despite her father's vigilance, Lauren Olamina knows her neighbourhood cannot survive. Convinced there must be other ways of living, Lauren sets off on foot along California's coastal highways, and as her dangerous journey unfolds, and fuck me, is it dangerous, in the blurb, she sows the seeds of a whole new philosophy of life.
There we go.
Now, I saw a criticism of the book. I'll start with this.
Yeah.
To say... On the ground, things are pretty bad, at least in Lauren's community.
Yep.
Violence is prevalent.
Yep.
Yet the government still has money for space programs, which are only just beginning to close up at the start of the book.
Yeah.
How's that possible?
Well, you know what? One of the things I found so refreshing about this particular book, because it is set in a near future dystopia, it's set around about the time the world is ending. It is in the middle. It's not post-apocalyptic.
No.
It is within
the apocalypse. Yeah, money is still usable.
Money's still usable.
Which I found off-putting in a weird way.
There is still government.
Yes.
Like, this is the thing. We are at
not
the very...
Not very good government, but it's
No,
there.
Well, you know, there's increasing privatisation of things because the government doesn't have any money to spend on the police and other things like that. So the police is incredibly corrupt.
Slavery's made a return. Through corporations.
Corporate slavery. Indentured servitude has made a return, through company towns and things like that, or beginning to. This was fascinating. This is, aside from the front story of Lauren and what she gets up to, the world building in this was fascinating because I can't even think of another book off the top of my head that actually puts us at the very – beginning beginning of a slow apocalypse.
I think the point is that the funding, you know, would have run out for space exploration, like it has essentially now.
Well, I don't know.
Well before the you'd have been at this stage.
Sure, maybe. But I don't know.
I didn't give a fuck. I mean,
I know it's set in the US. We should say
yes.
And I mean, it was written in 93, so we're talking 15 odd years.
It's horribly ago. Prescient.
It is so sense. Prescient. It is so. It's like it's just. it's sure you're not writing about it now, because it's just a shift. It really is just a shift, and with that fucking Carrot Top in the White House, hopefully that won't happen. It's June 25th, 2016. I just felt the need to date stamp this podcast at the moment. But honestly, look, we aren't American. We don't live in America. So we only get reports from outside. Yeah. You know, we can look in. But, you know, Australia's not that much better, let me just say. But, like, with the breakdown of community, the fact that you have the uber rich and then you have people who are living so far below the poverty line looks like middle class to them.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't find this unimaginable. I didn't find it unimaginable there would be such a disparity of wealth and such an imbalance in government priorities. Like, I mean, yes, I can see the argument that, well, why is there still a space program? But why are billions and billions and billions of dollars being spent on wars? I mean, why is the military-industrial complex so powerful? Like, yeah. The money that is fed into that. You know, and this is an America very much on a downward spiral. So whether the space program is being maintained as a prestige thing, how much the space program is actually doing at this stage, yeah. I don't know. None of that is gone into in any detail. But as I said, I found
Well, but it's a catalyst for Lauren because she sees Lauren. That as the hope.
Yeah, yeah, because she sees the hope
because her whole philosophy of Earthseed is about God has changed,
yeah.
But that change.
But the ultimate goal is leaving Earth yeah. and going and becoming a seed, seeding other planets.
Correct.
But yeah, no, as I said, I found it deeply fascinating and incredibly well constructed, this world at the beginning of an apocalypse. Like, this is not post-apocalyptic fiction. And that, as I said, that's rare because often these types of books, like, bang, the world has ended, however you want to define ended. And, you know, that's it. There's no currency. There's no government. There's just people. Yep. Like, that's, you know, and this is just before that. Like, this is the beginning of that. Currencies begin because they have hyperinflation. So it's beginning to be devalued to the point yeah, where it certainly won't be.
Everyone
worth,
lives in a gated you know. Community, and those gated communities have a sense of safeness, but they're not because because they can be overrun. As
and, you know, the police Lawrence's. Don't care, yep. and they're corrupt, and they'll take bribes, and
yep.
you know, they'll often loot themselves. So, you know, it's like this is a world beginning to crumble, beginning to lose a lot of the abstractions that we have in place.
We don't like know money, much about like what's government. Happening elsewhere, though. It doesn't have a global feel to it.
No, well, it certainly feels like the politics of the globe have shifted radically.
Well, I suppose that's the one, and this is not Octavia Butler's fault, it's the one difference that would happen now in that because internet is not a thing, well, in 1993, AOL had barely got off the ground. So yeah. Her future, which is what, 2024.
Yeah.
Doesn't have – there's no internet.
No, okay. There's no internet. There's no mobile phones. All this technology hasn't
– And that's Durfred. We know that. Yeah. But the point being that would be – this would be more global than it's depicted in this book.
Yeah. And as we don't know how global it is. We don't know that – because we only have Lauren's.
No, but if you were to write this exact book today –
Oh, I see what you mean.
Lauren would probably be communicating or be aware of what's going on in other countries.
It is one of
just
these,
by the sheer fact of being internet.
Yeah, exactly. It is one of these you just like with the work of Connie Willis, you and her time travel.
The Doomsday Book stuff and things like that.
Yeah, that world of the time travel, like it, and the ones we talked about, Blackout and All Clear, were set around this
that toy future.
Yeah, but again, you have to be forgiving as a reader because yes, if the author is creating this world back before there is the internet and phones,
yeah, absolutely.
So you have to kind of shift this and go, okay, this is not our world because if this was 2024 in our world, everyone would still have phones and burners and there'd be some kind of internet, and that would that would probably be a key. Like water is the key in this book, which is very interesting. But I think also getting internet access would be huge in this world, and that would be something people would be running around paying for to try and get, you know. But that was obviously before 1993 when Octavia Butler was writing this book. So you kind of have to shift it and say, this is an alternate
future. I'm not being anal about this because the book doesn't have internet. It's, you know, because how fresh is the writing? I mean,
it's beautiful.
That's why I actually raised the point, because you could have this book. Well, I did. I picked it up 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And it felt like a book that was written today.
Yeah.
Narratively. And I'm not saying that.
And to be honest, I didn't even think about the internet mobile phone shit. I just didn't even think about it. It didn't even enter my head as I'm reading it going, well, why haven't they just picked it? You know, because the book is so.
I didn't think of it like that. I thought of it, this is such a fresh piece of writing. It's this oddness that it doesn't have that technological stuff in it. But it's not, oh, why doesn't it? It's more just, how fresh is this?
Yeah. No. I think one of the things I loved about it
Which sounds patronising, doesn't it, to say, ooh, a lady in 1993 wrote a book that has fresh writing in it. I mean, it sounds so terrible. But
15 years ago, oh, my God. Actually, is it 93? Oh, no, it's a bit more than 25 years ago.
It's nearly 25 years old, this book.
Indeed. It's like, well, we have a very short sense of history now, don't we?
Well, it's nearly a generation old.
Yeah.
Let's be fair.
Yeah, but the idea that is so long ago. How on earth could we read something and it wouldn't feel like Chaucer? But I agree with you. I read, speaking of authors, I should have read long before now, but last year I read a lot of Tiptree's fiction, and I actually hadn't read any short fiction by Tiptree or the novels, to be honest. But I hadn't read any. I thought, I'm going to read some Tiptree. So I borrowed a book from the library that was a best of or something. I was like, part of me was quite astonished that, oh, my God, this feels so readable. Like, it's so readable. But it feels so contemporary.
Lessing's 5 years before this in 88, and it felt like a book written in the 1960s.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. But But then on the other hand, I do remember that when I read like Asimov and Heinlein and all of these, you know, the guys, when I was already like a teenager, that was already feeling quite stilted and old to me. It felt old-fashioned. Whereas
There's a perfunctory nature to his prose,
but also Heinlein, not perfunctory, but there is an older-fashioned style that I kind of associated with that golden age fiction. And then I read Tiptree, who's writing at the same time. I'm thinking, fuck, this could have been written now. Like, in terms of the style and the way it was written, it's like, it's deeply fascinating to me. Anyway, so that's kind of a segue. But yes, I agree.
Well, it's not a segue because part of what we're talking about here is authors we've not read.
Okay. Yeah.
We've not read Butler.
Mm.
So what's the fear the Butler gets forgotten? And I think as the years go on, it gets larger, although there is this Sci-Fi Channel doing a TV adaptation of one of her series.
Cool.
No, I can't remember. But the point being, in the minds of us genre fans, she's not going to be forgotten anytime soon.
Mm.
But that's the fear. And the point I'm making about this particular book is,
to be honest, I wonder how many people outside genre know Heinlein. Seriously.
I was just listening to a New York Times podcast and Heinlein was mentioned.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. I stayed corrected. Fuck.
No, it's still, I mean, no, the average, but if we went down the streets of Ballarat, I don't think many people would know who Robert Heinlein was. But I'm not talking about it in that.
Melbourne.
But even within the niche of genre, where does Butler sit? And is she slowly being forgotten that's being eroded? Same with Lessing.
I think Doris Lessing has subsided in prominence. I do. And part of that is that I don't think she was ever squarely in genre to start with.
No, fair. She wasn't. But Butler was.
Yeah, Butler always was.
And the point I'm making is that this book feels like it could have been written yesterday.
Yeah. It's in, like, as you say, the tone of it.
I sort of wish people would put down the latest, and I'm saying this to myself, not to the audience. I wish I would put down the latest craze novel or whatever and read this instead, because it's good shit.
But I guess this is there's so much new stuff being published, and there's this almost overwhelming pressure to keep up. So, you know, when there are, like, let's say there are 50 new books this year that you think you should read, well, how the hell do you have room in your life to even read them, let alone fill the gaps of stuff you haven't read?
Yeah, but the thing is that Butler is doing stuff in 1993 that was still
Oh, yeah, no.
That progressed in.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
She's having the discussions about gender and race.
Yeah, absolutely.
That we're still piss-farting around. Yeah, we haven't used her as a platform to move on. And
no,
other
I
writers
agree.
Like Tiptree to move on. That's the tragedy of the genre at the moment.
I agree. But I mean, as I'm saying,
generalization, because
like,
there's always.
Yeah, but with so much being published, like there, and as I said to you, like short attention span in terms of history. But that's part of the thing is that we're all, you know, the joke that, oh, everything, you know, on the internet a year ago is like, oh God, forever. Why would you bother reading it? But it's kind of true. There's this enormous pressure, I think, at the moment to stay on top of what's being published now. Not even yesterday, now, right now.
Yeah,
right
absolutely.
Now. And because there's so much being written, not just in terms of books, but in commentary and all this sort of stuff, the idea that, you know, it almost feels like a luxury to go, well, I'm going to read a book that's 25 years old. Why not? You know, it's not part of the conversation at the moment. I'll have to not read a new book that everyone's talking about and I won't be able to take part in that conversation. I mean, it's – and I find it really,
that's
really
it.
Sad.
Butler stops becoming part of the dialogue.
Yeah.
And this is such a prescient novel that
and
it should be absolutely steadfast in it.
Absolutely.
So when Paolo Bacigalupi writes The Water Knife, which I've not read, but it is about water rights.
Yeah.
We should be talking about this book too in concert with it. I mean, obviously you don't have to. No, I'm putting a gun in anyone's head. But water rights is such a critical part of this book too.
But no, I
in
know.
A different, completely different way. But you know what I'm saying?
No, I absolutely know what you're saying. And I think one of the issues is that as writers, to be blunt, when writers die, they stop publishing, clearly. So when writers stop publishing, either because they've died or because they've just stopped publishing, when no more new books come out, they do almost by default leave the conversation. If there's not something new, we don't remember them.
Unless you're the rare breed. You're Shakespeare, for example.
You've
got to throw Shakespeare in at least once every second podcast.
What I'm saying is because of the way that we – because of the way the conversation is carried out these days, which is, for the most part, online, new books and the work of authors come to light often because the authors themselves are online, writing blog posts, doing interviews, on Twitter, on Facebook. They are kind of part of the conversation. If you are no longer able to be part of the conversation because you are dead, your work is not being out there anymore. I mean, it's a significant issue, you know. They're not front and center. They haven't written a blog post. They haven't written an article on tor.com. You know, it relies on other people to be talking about their work and keeping it alive and keeping it relevant, because it is relevant. It's just we've all forgotten about it because Octavia Butler, you know, like Ursula Le Guin, who is incredibly prolific and I'm not even talking about her fiction, but in terms of her output online. And so every few months, oh, have you seen this thing Ursula Le Guin wrote or this speech that she gave? And so she's there. I'm genuinely worried, probably not because it is Ursula Le Guin, I'm genuinely worried that when she is no longer with us, her influence will begin to fade simply because she's no longer with us to talk to us directly. And I genuinely worry about that because she is a woman writer. And get silenced easily.
No, but do you think that is the key problem?
And Octavia, no, I don't think it's the key problem. I think it is a key problem. I honestly do. I think when authors are no longer around to speak to us directly because online presences are such an important part and an author being in conversation, whether that's directly, you know, because they're on Twitter all the time or they have a blog or whether they're just alive so they get interviewed when a new book comes out, right? This is what I mean, because we value new content so much now that it has become sort of the primary driver of what we read and what we talk about. When there's no more new content, whether that's new books published or whether that's new discourses published by the author because they are still alive and talking on the internet, then what happens? Like, I do honestly think it's a genuine issue. And I don't have any solutions.
No, there is no solutions.
Except that, you know, people, I guess, like this podcast and people who do commentary on the internet and so on do need to keep refreshing.
And, you know, and to its credit, you know, I mean, I read the ebook version, which is published by, I think, Open Road, I think is their name. Or the point being that the people are – that if the state allows it, these books are being republished, you know.
Well, I mean, that's the other issue. For some of, like, authors who were published longer ago – and the books are physically out of print and there might be issues with the estate, maybe their stuff isn't even available readily or cheaply to read. And that's obviously another issue. If you can't read the books, no one's going to talk about them or read them. So yeah, I don't know. I think the tyranny of the present is a real problem. The tyranny of now.
The other tragedy is that 23 years later, I'm reading a book by a person of colour that still feels terribly unique in terms of the race of the person writing the book. Not to get into identity politics, but
I agree with you.
In terms of promoting people of colour who write science fiction, and that the fact that that if you're going to do a list, Octavia Butler's the person you probably turn to. And there's been no one since. And I'm talking about
She is the Ursula Gwynne,
the
African American science fiction.
Look, I know there's Stephen Barnes and Samuel Delaney and other, you know, people of colour who've written, but a woman as well. And depresses me. I mean, there's others. I mean, I know there are.
N.K. Jemisin.
I know that. But we don't. And Nnedi Okorafor, who's written some fantastic science fiction recently. But the conversation never really gets past 1990-something, often.
Well, the conversation, one of the conversations at the moment, one of the conversations that we are having as white Western.
I just want to say I've contradicted myself. I've both said that Octavia Butler is being forgotten and also is probably the only token person that gets brought up when we do our lists and that in 21st century. So it's a contradiction, I accept.
No, but I think one of the problems is that when we, you know, white Western science fiction people do talk about this stuff, the conversation hasn't really moved on from the idea that, oh, look, here's a black writer writing science fiction. You know, like that is part of it.
Yeah.
Which is
there shouldn't be a special snowflake tag attached to every time a person of colour writes SF.
No, exactly. But, you know, as I said, like when the dominant discourse subsumes this stuff, that is still very much part of the conversation. And it really shouldn't be.
Anyway, I don't want to derail the whole conversation about that because this is a fucking awesome book.
And that's, really
at the end of the day, all that aside, this is just a five-star brilliant novel. It's compelling from page one. I zipped through this, and not because it's an easy read. It's not an easy read. It is grim and it's dark and it's violent.
But it's
and people highly, die horribly.
But it's highly optimistic, and part of that is Lauren because she's so optimistic about the future.
Well, she's optimistic, but also this whole concept that, which is new to me, this idea of God as change or change as God, and this idea of adaptation, the constant need to adapt to whatever shit is being thrown to you, and the fact that change or God doesn't care that much about what you think.
Yeah, like
you've got to. Yeah,
it's almost a. I mean, she does like, and it's all the way through it. The Earthseed philosophy that or religion that she's kind of building up. And we should say she's a teenager. She's quite young.
Yeah,
like I don't it, like. It, I found it quite fascinating, because it's all like God is change and so on. But it's almost that you can actually just take God out of that, and she kind of does because God is indifferent. God doesn't – like her God, which is, I guess, change and everything that's bound up in change, so evolution and entropy both, is completely different. And it's not a God that you get on side with or offside with. And there's no heaven. Her heaven is a very real physical place. It's going to another planet.
Yes.
It's going to the stars. That's her heaven. It's not like when you die, then you go to a place. Like it's almost an atheistic religion.
Well, it is. It absolutely is.
You could take any idea of a godhead
out of it. No, it's very much a secularist point of view.
It's just about the guiding principles of life.
The reason I think the reason she uses God is because of her upbringing.
Yeah.
Her father's a reverend or pastor.
Yeah, she's exchanging the idea of the Christian God that she's been brought up with.
The book starts with her being baptized.
Yeah, yeah.
And how uncomfortable she felt going to it and how uncomfortable
she feels.
Because
she no longer believes in,
and
that
she's
type of a God.
This is a form of secularism, but it's one that I had not thought of.
Yeah, but it's couched in phrases of around God and
praying.
Well,
it gives it a vague New Agey crystal good vibes feel, but only very vaguely.
Well,
no,
because she's always, like, in all of, like, I guess what will become her teachings or what begin to be her teachings by the end of the book, she's all very much about, like, it's not New Age in the way that, oh, just think positive. And she's all very much about you have to work and you have to work hard and you have to make change and you have to adapt and you have to, you know, praying is not like just sitting there going, dear God, can you please make this happen? It's the opposite of that. Praying is work. Work is prayer in a way.
I'm going to be controversial. It has a sniff of the Ayn Rand by your bootstraps philosophy to it as well. Oh, well, when you're rolling your eyes, sorry, let me get to it.
Oh, so that's just my instinctive face when you say that name.
Or the libertarian view, because it is about adapting to change and you adapting and you being, you know, but where it differs, in other words, the government's not going to come and help you to do that. But where it differs is this idea of community.
That I was
and
about
family.
To say,
it is
anti-libertarian from the point of view that it's not about the individual.
Correct.
And in fact, it's
individualistic in the sense that, you know, when one of them fucks up later in the novel, isn't guarding properly, you know, Lauren is pretty full on saying, well, that's your fucking job. You've got to do it.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's not that people don't have roles. It's not that people are an amorphous mass. But the idea is it's not about the importance of the individual, only in that individuals all work together to create community. And no one can set out on their own. I mean, that's kind of one of the guiding themes of the book is as they're – because after her community gets destroyed by outsiders, Lauren, whose whole family's been killed – leaves and she gradually picks up other people along the way. And they eventually, because they're walking along the freeways and highways and roads heading north because they've come from the Los Angeles area and they're heading north where the idea is that there's safer places and more land and so on. So that's where they're going. But like the point's made several times that as their group becomes bigger, they become more formidable and people are more wary of them and they're less likely to be attacked by the, you know, either the roving drug fiends who set fire to everything or just opportunists or thieves or brigands. So the idea that community is the most important thing and the individual cannot survive is really important.
And yes, and now let's be clear here, the genius aspect of this is this is coming from someone who has a mutation.
Oh, yeah, hyper-empathy syndrome.
The hyper-empathy syndrome, which means if someone around her feels pain, she feels it as well. So
Or pleasure. Pain is more common.
But pain is more common. Yes. Someone like that would say, fuck community, I'm going to live as a hermit somewhere.
Right.
I don't want to be around anyone. Yeah. Oh, yeah, oh, every so often someone has sex and I get the orgasm. Great.
But, you know, when someone gets shot,
I die.
I get shot. Well, not literally.
I feel death.
Yeah, she feels death.
I mean, she obviously doesn't die, but she feels it.
Yeah.
You would think you'd run a mile from that. I've got to say, there are points in this book I felt so queasy and so, just the way Butler expresses it through Lauren. And especially when she has to pick off someone, shoot someone. And, thinking about it now, gives me the quiver.
If someone is not like
– heebs jeebs.
Yeah.
It does me –
yeah, no, and it's not just people too, because like she will have the same connection with like a dog, and not like a pet dog, just a wild dog.
Correct.
If the dog is shot and doesn't die straight away,
correct.
She will
feel their lingering
to a lesser extent
but
than
still
she
feel
does
their lingering
human.
Pain. Yeah,
yeah, and as you say, I hadn't like quite thought about it in that way, but yeah, the idea that someone who has this hyper empathy syndrome, instead of going, I'm going to go away from the world. goes into the world and gathers people.
And the
to
other bit
her.
Of genius, the other thing that I really appreciated is that she's not this special, almost mystical figure. You can tell that there's a mythology that's going to build around her just by the nature.
Yeah.
But she has to convince people of her Earthsea philosophy.
She does.
People say, you're talking shit.
Yeah. And we'll come with you because there's safety in numbers and you're kind of a nice person.
But your
Earthsea stuff. One of the sisters who they pick up, who they rescue out of a crumbled building, they're so stunned to be rescued for a start because like most people don't bother with other people these days. But like one of them actually says, like, if you come with you, do we have to join your cult?
Well, that's the thing. These
and
are not apostles.
Like, and Lauren's like, no.
These are not apostles.
No,
they may
not.
Become apostles. It's
yeah.
not. I don't know. We haven't read the second book. But
their
safety. And I love that bit.
Yeah. And, like, I love that, like, she's got this and as I said, I don't know what happens in the second book, whether it becomes more useful, but she's got this hyper-empathy syndrome. And it's not a superpower.
No, it's not.
It's not like she ever uses it in any way to her own or anyone else's benefit.
It's bad.
You know,
it knocks her out.
Like I kind of kept waiting for this hyper-empathy thing to suddenly kick in and like, here's the positive.
The only advantage it has that I could tell is that she senses danger earlier.
No.
Like the dog's coming if someone else is being hurt.
Oh, if someone's, but she has the line of sight to people though.
True.
It's not like someone's just hurt over the hill and I feel it. Like she needs to see.
True.
She needs.
I just got the feel that she sensed. Not.
I don't think so.
No, okay, fine.
I think she's just. She's very aware. I don't think that's related to her hyper empathy stuff. But she's quite aware of her surroundings and changes in her surroundings and noises and so on. She's quite. She's a very capable young woman. Like she doesn't just have this leadership thing going, which she clearly does, but she's very thoughtful. She's very considered. She plans a lot, and she plans for contingencies a lot. She's always thinking ahead about what might go wrong and how could you avoid that and what would be the thing. Yep. Like she's incredibly capable and self-aware, and yeah, she was a fantastic. I'm can't even say character. She felt like a person to me. She was a real person walking in the
world. So why haven't you read the second book straight away?
Because I have a PhD.
Is that going to be your excuse about everything?
Yes.
Like a decade from now?
Not a decade from now. Oh, God, no, not a decade from now.
No, but I could ask the same question to myself.
Yeah. But no, I...
Because she did
well,
feel
apart
real.
From the fact that I only just finished reading this, like this week. So haven't got a chance to get, but I think I will when I return this to the library. I will get the second one and read it because I really do. I want to find out where that goes. It was a really compelling narrative, and in a world, and he's the thing which interests me because it's, as I said, if you compare it to say The Road by Cormac McCarthy, yeah. Which has the same horrible world, dog-eat-dog world. There's even, like, there's a scene in The Parable of the Sower where there's children who are roasting a human leg over yeah. a fire. Now, it's yeah. not quite the baby being roasted over the fire that's in The Road, but it's a similar thing,
it sends
right?
the same message.
It sends the same message. And the idea that these are children, yeah. so they're young people that are now growing up in this... By well, necessity.
Cannibalism.
Yeah, but by necessity, yeah. right? Because food, meat especially, is incredibly hard to come by. People don't have dogs anymore as pets. Dogs are roaming feral animals because people don't have dogs as pets because you need to feed dogs meat, and no one is going to feed meat to a dog if they have meat. But this book, unlike The Road, I think this book is so incredibly optimistic.
It is, isn't it?
It really is, and it shouldn't be. But this is – I think it – like. When like we're currently living in the world, and at the moment, for various reasons, the world feels like a really shitty place.
And 2016 especially.
It doesn't feel like a place that has a lot of room for optimism, but that's the world. And I think if we look at our inner circle, so our communities, our friends, like I don't know about you, but those circles for me are pretty damn good.
Yeah, they are.
You know?
Yeah, they are. My close-knit community, yeah.
And this is, yeah, I think, absolutely. What this book is saying. Like, everything begins close to home, and we can't, like Lauren, we can't just close off the world. You know, you have to be careful in the world. You can't be naive about stuff. And she's not naive. She's never naive. And she's very careful and considered about the people who she invites into her party, as it were. But she does invite people into her party. She's not insular. She's not... You know, she hasn't got this back against the wall, kill them all mentality.
Correct. That's the point. She's not out just to shoot people.
Yeah. And you know, she and it's not just because, and part of it might be, like part of that might be because of her hyper empathy syndrome. Yeah. You know, she, you know, well, if you hurt people, I get hurt. So therefore I shouldn't hurt people. So that might have contributed to this worldview. But I think primarily it's a philosophical thing. You will only kill when you have to. And when you have to is defined by if you will get killed otherwise.
How
otherwise, you just don't go out and kill. And you don't,
how
and 90, you don't steal from
how
people.
How 90s is the fire, the clowns, well, the painted face people. With the, you could just see if this was done as a movie.
Oh, my God.
How 90s they'd look. Sniffing the drugs and going off to
the fire. Who have this one particular drug that they like, which is called a few
pyro.
Things, but pyro. Yeah. But it basically makes fire really attractive to them, like the flickering motions of fire. Yeah. So they get high and go and burn shit. Because and they, you know, also hyper violent when they're high, and they don't have, I guess, like with various other drugs that we currently have, like their thresholds to pain is raised, and they don't
they're really, the Mad Max aspect
they are,
of the
they're
book.
The Mad Max aspect of the book, but we don't get to see them too often. The threat of them is more prevalent than their actual presence most of the time.
Yeah, true.
But, yeah, no, so, oh, gosh.
And we haven't really spoken about, because it doesn't focus on it, it's just a thing that goes on in the background, the indentured stuff going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, so.
In fact, I compare this to a book that just came out, last year by Margaret Atwood's latest novel, The Heart Goes Last, which again is set at a very similar point.
I've not read that yet.
Yeah, don't bother.
Oh, okay.
It's not very good. That which makes is the point I'm going to make. It's set at a very similar point in time that the apocalypse hasn't happened, but it's happening. And people are, I mean, the two main characters are living out of their car essentially. And yes, it's a company town to set up. And anyway, it's treated like a farce, which is why I don't like it. But that looks at, that's the point.
Oh, is that the one about like a sex community or something?
Well, it's they build sex bots is one.
Right, okay.
Yeah, yep. So that's one aspect of the community, that they actually build sex bots for rich people.
Right.
It just and then it becomes Elvis impersonators and all sorts of other shit. It's I don't know. Well, I don't know what Atwood was trying to do. I don't know. Have a laugh. I don't know. But and therefore doesn't really explore this whole concept of indentured slavery because it gets – into its own stupidities.
Mm.
Whereas this, even without actually having it set in a company town, still resonates and provides that horror of what these towns do.
Yeah, so the –
that's why I made the comparison.
Yeah,
this one's set in a company town.
And it doesn't convey that.
Not at all.
No. So, well that's – I mean, that's what I was talking about when I say the world building in this book is exquisite because you even though you don't see a lot of it firsthand, the information that Butler filters through about what else is happening in society and how it's contributing to the mess that things are. And one of the things is because the government seems like it might be on the verge of bankruptcy and there's hyperinflation and super high unemployment and all of that sort of stuff. And the living wage is like way below what actual, you know, the poverty line is, corporations are moving in to set up towns where you come to live and you'll get a job and you live in a house that they build and everything, but the job that they give you, the wages you earn will not cover the cost of your rent and your bills, so therefore you owe the company money, so therefore you have to keep working for the company.
Yep.
And this is there's a suggestion that this has been – like it's all kind of hearsay at this point, but people are telling Lauren and so on that this government has changed legislations to make this – permissible. And this is a desired outcome for some people. Some people are like, no way, no way. Interestingly enough, it's if I'm remembering correctly, it's the black characters in the book who are going, there's no fucking way I'm going to those company towns. Like, you know, no fucking way. My grandparents remember slavery. Yeah, fuck off. Not slavery necessarily.
Well, it's in Lawrence's family, a father says that, but the mother, when she starts to get desperate.
She's not black though.
Ah, yeah, good point.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. Like it's the white people in the book who go, I'm going to the company town because they don't have any experience either directly or has been passed down through the family of what that actually means. They don't have any experience of it.
Yeah.
And it's not you know, quite slavery, but it is indentured servitude and it wouldn't be too hard to slip over to outright slavery.
Yep.
Yeah, so I found that really interesting that it's the black characters who are like, fuck off with your company town, and the white ones who are like, it's safe, I'm going. You know, and I thought that was really subtle because no one says it. It's not like Lauren's going, oh, those crazy white people. You know, like no one actually.
But Lauren's group has a mix of.
Oh, it does. Yeah, no, Lauren,
black and white people
and Hispanic and a whole. Yeah, no, it is. It's a very diverse group. Because she's choosing people based mostly, I think, on their personality. Actually, there's no like interview about what skills do you have and what can you bring to our organization. It's mostly people who she still feels like are nice. Like have, you know, are willing to help each other, are willing to cooperate.
They're willing to engage with the common good.
Are willing to subsume their own direct needs for the, as you say, for the greater good of the community. And so that's the basis upon which she's selecting people, even if to begin with they may have no other actual skill or knowledge that would be directly helpful at this time. Yeah, we could really talk forever about this book, couldn't we? I did love it so much. But the other thing I want to talk about briefly, because I've mentioned it in the past, this book is written as a journal, and it's written explicitly as a written journal.
Yes, it is. Oh, I knew. Okay, yep.
And I loved the way it was written.
Like, so it didn't break.
She plays with that format like so much.
Yeah, because
so,
there's all this continued and
that's right.
This is events bits. Of the eight. Yeah,
there's bits where she's like dated it, but then underneath it's in brackets like, oh, you know, expanded from notes on. Yeah. So she like you don't sit there going, well, how did she have time to write these 10 pages while they were being attacked? Because no, they're not. And she says, well, I
did it 5 days later.
Scribbled some notes and a week later when I had time to sit down, I've then written this out. And it, you know, again, because it's a journal, it's clearly from Lauren's point of view. And they're most like it's pretty equally balanced between her just telling and paraphrasing and describing, and there are patches of direct dialogue and stuff. But because the whole thing is explicitly and repeatedly offered up as a construction, as something that she's often remembering weeks, at least days later, you know that she. And it builds up slowly. In the beginning, there's not as much direct dialogue, and you just get the impression that as she's going along and recording these journals, and she's writing Earthseed stuff in them too, she's becoming, I guess, it feels like she's becoming as a character more cognizant of the fact that she is writing formation documents.
Yeah, that's right.
So she's starting to write them as using more conventional narrative devices, like swathes of direct dialogue and little scenes. But you're never led to believe that they're not constructed by
Lauren.
Yeah,
that's right.
That you know that's not the exact.
It feels like a journal from Go
yeah,
Away.
That's not the exact dialogue. Obviously, people would have said she's remembered what they've said. So
yeah,
you
right.
take it all with a grain of salt. Yeah. And so maybe people are a bit like I like to think that like she's very clear-eyed, but I wonder if people are maybe less nice than she says they are.
Maybe the next
like
book has
really
that. Maybe the next book covers that.
Yeah, I that might be me being too cynical, but I just love that she's such, you know, for all of the shit that's happened, and you know, by the time they're on the road, she's lost her entire family. She's seen people being raped. She she's seen people who have been raped in the aftermath of that. She's seeing dead bodies and dead children. Like there's all this horror that's like she's surrounded in, and she's so optimistic, and she's like, you just can't.
But not optimistic in a mawkish, sentimental.
No, not in a naive way.
Practical optimism.
But she never wavers from the certainty.
There's no angst in a sense.
No, but she has an absolute certainty that they will get to a place that they can build a community, and ultimately that humankind will leave Earth.
Yes, correct.
Like she's never wavers from that, no matter how shitty things get. And they've gotten about as shitty as you can get. I mean, the parable of the book of Job is mentioned several times throughout, and that's kind of like you talk about the character having everything stacked against them. She's kind of everything is stacked against
her. Yeah, but I'm for – yeah, difference being Lauren's not being punished specifically.
Well, not Lauren specifically, but as with the book of Job, you know. I mean, she's being punished. She's got that fucking hyper-empathy thing. But as with the book of Job, everything happens to those around her because, honestly, it's a journal. If she died.
It would be a pretty quick book.
So, but yeah, no, I loved it. I'm really looking forward to reading the second one, and I hope to have that done in the next, by the end of the year, certainly. But yeah, so that was Parable of the Sower by Octavia Butler, and I'm really glad we read both these books. Now, we have some corrections from the last podcast in regards to the Aurealis Awards. We got a couple of things incorrect. The first, I guess, significant one is a change since I was last doing it of it's only the author or the publisher who can actually fill out a nomination form for a work on the website. Anyone can still write to the conveners and to Aurealis and suggest a work which they've come across that they think should be considered, and then the Aurealis will then attempt to contact the author and or publisher and say, oh, look, your work has been brought to our attention. We think you should submit it to the awards. But now only the publisher or the author can actually fill out the official form. So there's that.
And we also got the winner.
And, yeah, most embarrassingly, and I don't even know how this happened, Dayboy did not co-win the young adult category. In the Skin of a Monster won that on its own. The second award that Dayboy won was Ian?
Fantasy? What? Oh, what? It won horror.
You sound so sure.
It won horror
and fantasy. Yes.
Yeah, it won horror and fantasy. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, I got it right. Why are you laughing at me?
No, it's just the way you said it. So I might get it wrong again. So I don't even know how we got that, but that was complete stuff up. So, yep, correction to the, to that. Dayboy did win two awards, but it didn't co-win Best Young Adult Novel.
Yeah, that was...
In the Skin of a Monster won that on its own. So, yeah, so that's the corrections, and apologies to Aurealis for getting the nomination process.
Really undermines our entire rant when we get basic pieces of information incorrect.
Well, look, I stand by the fact that
no,
that
you can't stand by anything we said in that last podcast.
People can still, you know, write into Aurealis and suggest something. They just can't fill out the actual nomination form.
You just
but yeah, people, if you do come across something, that write to the Aurealis guys, and if you don't see it on the list, and suggest they try to chase it up. So,
okay.
I guess I'm also, I should mention that I'm judging the Aurealis Horror Novel Award this year. Yeah.
So just that expect, yeah. Enjoy that, Kirsten. I expect a full report that you probably will have to censor out because we won't be able to talk about
it. No, we won't. We will. I'm, even though we're allowed to talk about and review books that we are reading for the awards while we're reading them, we won't do that this year.
No problems.
It makes me a bit uncomfortable.
No problems.
But yes, so that's the corrections. Now, the other big news we need to finish off, well, not news so much as development, is the Patron's Choice episode that we're doing in August.
Correct.
We've closed the nominations for that, and we got a dozen or so nominations, and that's really good. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to put up, because I had a look, and Patreon doesn't seem to have the options for an actual poll on their site, which is a bit weird. But so I'm going to create a poll and put a link up for all those people who are eligible to vote.
Yeah, gotcha.
So I'll put a post up on Patreon with a link to the poll. So if you see that, you're one of the people who are eligible to vote, and you go to the poll and just select the book that you would like us to talk about. And everyone just gets one vote for one book, and the top two books are the ones we're going to talk about. In the event of a draw, I don't think we can talk about three books. We might just have to flip a coin. if we get two that have equal numbers, that's fine. But if we get three that have equal numbers, we're just going to have to work something out, roll a die.
Can you ask the listeners to make sure that doesn't happen?
I don't think they have any control over that. That would be called stacking the ballot. so that will be live around about the same time this podcast is. So, as I said, if you can see that post on our Patreon site, you are eligible to vote, and go and vote. Because, that was a really good list of nominations, actually.
There's quite a couple
I'm looking forward to reading.
There's a couple I actually want to read. But anyway, I don't want to prejudice the vote.
So that will be done. And I think I'm going to leave the voting up until about mid-July, because we do need to have time to read the books before the next podcast. So there'll be a couple of weeks to vote on that.
And that's it for me.
For you.
Yep. You want
to... Well, I'd like to finish.
Okay, yeah. Oh, all right.
I know, we got to talk about next month.
Oh, yeah, shit.
Like, for goodness sake.
Yeah, Christ.
Okay, so next month, our theme, and you decided on this, Ian, was New York Times bestsellers, and you've chosen The Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins and All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr.
Now, these are books that have been on the list forever at the moment.
And they're both ones I've been kind of quasi-interested in reading.
Well, the Hawkins is about to be turned into, if not already being turned into a movie.
Yeah. So I'm up for reading that.
So it wasn't just picked a bestseller right
now.
No,
it's like the ones that are perennials almost.
I think they've both been up for 60, 70 weeks.
Yeah,
so if not longer. We'll discuss that
we're
more.
We're going to see what's all the fuss is about.
Well, I actually read one of them.
You pre-read?
Well, no, not... yes, I've read one of them. Not,
okay. Anyway, so that's next month. The Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins and All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. So please send feedback to us if you feel the need by commenting at the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com, or you can send an email to writerandcritic@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at writerandcritic, and you mostly get Ian there.
And stop sending me bloody words.
And you can probably cease with the word sendage to Ian. Maybe there'll be something else at the end of this podcast.
No.
Oh, you've got to go. Oh, and also, if you can, we'd love it if you could sponsor us on Patreon. So thank you, everyone, for listening. It's been a super long podcast this time, I think. Yeah. So thank you, everyone, for listening, and you'll hear from us again sometime in late July. Bye.
Bye.
I like voting in a booth. I like getting the piece of paper. You know what I like doing?
I've done it before.
You know what I like doing? I like. You know what I like doing? I like
what?
Walking up to the polling booth and getting all of the bits of paper that they give you and just taking one from each person and saying thank you, and then going and voting, and then coming out and giving it all back to them.
You don't really do that.
I do.
You give it back to them. Well, you don't chuck it in the bin.
It's a waste of paper. I give it back to them.
Put it in a recycle bin.
I give it back to them so they can recycle it.
Don't they say, what are you doing? Why are you handing me this?
No, they're really happy. They're usually really happy to get them back because it costs them a lot of money.
Fuck me.
And I always take it from everyone. I'm not going to say who I'm voting for. So I always take it from everyone so they don't know.
Wait till you see the Senate ballot.
This year, I am not taking the fucking paper from Family Fucking First.
Yeah, good. Neither should you.